Hi, welcome to this episode of the Innovation Exchange podcast with me, your host, Dr. Hassan Jahan. In this series, I'll be guiding you through some of the key challenges facing the NHS today and bringing you some exciting innovations out there that respond to those needs. This episode was recorded prior to the COVID-19 pandemic and references some treatments that require social interaction. Where this is the case, each innovator diversified to comply with current restrictions by offering alternative ways of keeping the interaction virtual. We hope, as restrictions are lifted, that the face-to-face social interaction that's so valuable in many of these therapies can be reintroduced again. This time, we're focusing on substance addiction.
Anybody can get addicted at any time. Let's take a look at some stats. Alcohol-related harm is estimated to cost the NHS around £3.5 billion annually. In 2018, there were around 78,000 deaths attributed to smoking in England, and the UK has the highest prevalence of drug misuse in Europe. Addiction is a disease that is completely treatable, but how do we go about tackling it? Today, I'm here with Dr. Owen Bowden-Jones. Owen, tell us about yourself.
So thank you very much. My name's Owen Bowden-Jones. I'm a consultant psychiatrist and I work in the area of substance misuse problems. And I've been working in this area for around 20 years. And a little bit of background about me. So in 2010, I founded the Club Drug Clinic, which is a specialist service for people experiencing harms from emerging drugs such as ketamine, GHB and prescription medicines. And I also have written for the Royal College of Psychiatrists a book for parents on how to talk to their children about drugs, which is called The Drug Conversation.
Okay. And when we talk about addiction, what is it that we're actually talking about? How do you define addiction?
Well, I actually don't tend to use the word addiction because it's a hard to define term, and lots of people use different versions of it. So when I describe substances, I tend to use the WHO or the World Health Organization approach, and that's really determined by the concept of harm. So the WHO talks about three levels of harm. There is hazardous use, which means that there is the potential for harm to occur. Then there is harmful use, in which harm is actually occurring. And then there's dependent use. Now, interestingly, the WHO have recently revised their classification. And whereas before it just really talked about drugs and alcohol, they've added in behaviours for the first time. And the behaviour they've particularly added in is gambling. So that's now considered in amongst things like alcohol and heroin problems.
So, are you able to talk us through some of that neurobiology? So the science, I guess, behind the addiction process?
Absolutely. So the science is pretty complicated, to be honest. And I think when you talk about the science, It's important just to step back a moment and think about how these conditions occur, because it's very much more than science. And one of the things that really interests me about field is that it is absolutely you need to take a holistic approach to every patient, because it's not just about what's going on in their brain. It's what's going on in their immediate environment. It's what their friends are doing. It's what's happening in their community. So when you start thinking about addiction, you have to think about the genetics. So some of these conditions, certainly the vulnerability to some of these conditions, runs in families. You have to think about the cultural setting that someone's in. You have to think about the current mental state of that person. So if they're suffering with depression or anxiety, that makes them more vulnerable. If they're suffering with physical health problems such as chronic pain, that makes them more vulnerable. And you have to think about the broader sort of social environment that they're living in. And there's a very strong link between social deprivation and substance use. So before we get anywhere near the brain, we've got to be aware that there are lots of other factors that influence whether someone is vulnerable or indeed goes on to have a problem around substances.
I can see how that poses a challenge then when it comes to actually resolving the issue. So I guess before we talk about what we can do about it, I suppose what I'd like to know from you is what your opinion is in terms of numbers.
We still have an enormous amount of harm that these behaviours cost society. And I suppose if we were going to start to look at a harm, the harm we'd probably start with would be the most catastrophic harm, and that would be death. And so if we look at the the death-related data from the UK, around 2,000 people died of drug-related harm in the last year. That compares to about 30,000 people for alcohol-related harm, and that relates to about 80,000 people for smoking-related harm. And of course, that's just the tip of the harm iceberg, because the figures I just gave you were for death. But for every person who dies from a substance, there are an enormous number of people who are experiencing other types of harm for their physical health, for their mental health, for their relationships and their social functioning.
So those are pretty scary numbers, aren't they, Erin? So you know, as a doctor, I often have patients come to me with alcohol addiction or drug misuse. I'm always intrigued to know, actually, you know, what's led to these people developing these behaviours. And there may be people out there that take the other opinion, which is that this is self-inflicted, it's not my problem, these people are doing it to themselves, why should we help them? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the moral argument that this is some sort of failing of character has been roundly defeated by the science. We have now very good evidence of the underlying brain processes that can define addictions. We also have very good evidence of some of the vulnerabilities that people experience, depending on their genetic loading, depending on where they grow up, the environment they grow up with, the culture they grow up with. So I hope that we've moved well past an idea that this is some sort of self-inflicted choice. I see people who experience harm every day, and none of them start using a drug to end up in my clinic.
So if we were able to talk about some of your patients, could you perhaps take us through a patient journey for somebody that's come through your clinic in terms of how they started and how they progressed?
Yes, so my clinic might be slightly unusual compared to many traditional drug services. So the Club Drug Clinic does not treat people who are experiencing problems around heroin, crack cocaine or alcohol. But instead, we look at emerging drug harms. So the sort of journey that someone has into my clinic is they would start off perhaps using drugs recreationally and often go maybe a couple of years without having any sort of problem related to that. And then over time, they begin to find that they lose control of their drug use. And often it's precipitated by a social stress. So it might be a bereavement in the family. So essentially the drug then becomes something they use to take away feelings that they're unable to deal with. And before they know it, their drug use begins to take priority in their life. And before they know it, their life has fallen apart. And that's often the situation someone's in by the time they walk through the door of the Club Drug Clinic.
And what sort of services do they get at your clinic? What is it that you do to help them?
So the approach to someone who's got a problem around substances has to be very broad. So the approach we tend to use is a widely sort of recognized approach in medicine. So it's a biopsychosocial approach. So the biological approaches might be things such as a medically assisted detoxification for someone who's dependent, or perhaps the prescription of anti-craving medication for people who are really struggling to stop and keep relapsing. The psychological approaches we use, there are two main ones. So one is something called motivational interviewing, and the other is relapse prevention. And we use the motivational interviewing approach largely when we're trying to help people get the motivation to change. And then the relapse prevention approach is when people have stopped using, but we need to give them the skills to stay stopped. And then just as importantly is the social. So people can often make a terrible mess of their lives when they're in the grips of a harmful drug problem. So, for example, if someone's lost work, we might help them reapply for work, practice interviews, write a CV. We might do family work around the disruption they've caused in their relationships and their friendships.
We talked a little bit earlier about self-help, and you talked about your book. So one of the things, you know, we like to hear about is technology and innovation, be it apps or be it through maybe even technological services. Do you think that's moving within this field or the field of addiction, or do you think it's lagging behind?
Well, I think there's enormous opportunity for technology in the drug and alcohol field. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the funding for drug and alcohol services dropped quite dramatically over the last 5 or 6 years. And the other is that the drug and alcohol service or the drug and alcohol field has been subject to a sort of retendering and procurement process that's led to a fragmentation from other parts of the NHS. And so the pathways that I was describing a bit earlier, although we've worked very hard to develop those in our local area, in many areas, those pathways between the drug and alcohol service and mental health and physical health are not as well defined. And actually that fragmentation has led to, you know, blockages in those pathways. And that's a real problem, but it also is an opportunity, because it also is an opportunity to then work out, well, if we're not able to have a urologist there, or if we're not able to have the various other services that we need, how could we do something, perhaps using technology, perhaps using an app, that might help us either build those bridges or develop it and deliver it in a different way? The other thing to say is we've been talking really about treatment, but there are two other much larger, and some would argue more important areas. The first is prevention, and the second is harm reduction.
So I'm glad you touched on prevention, because I was going to ask you about that. So how do we identify these people? Because, you said earlier about genetics and the biopsychosocial model. So it's not as easy as being able to do a blood test when somebody's 10 and saying, right, you're somebody who's at risk of substance misuse or addiction as opposed to somebody else. So some of it is so complicated in terms of how their life progresses. So how do we pick those people that are likely to develop a problem? Is it around certain communities, or is it certain genetic characters? How are we going to try and stop this from happening?
Well, again, the starting point has to be to look what the science says. What does the evidence say? And there is a sort of emerging understanding around prevention that sort of broad brush, for example, schools, drug education, doesn't really seem to have a great impact on the level of drug use. What seems to be more effective is targeting educational programs at the most vulnerable. And so identifying the most vulnerable then becomes really important. And although it is complicated, perhaps identifying groups who might be more vulnerable is perhaps less complicated. So, for example, if you're thinking about a school, you might think of, for example, children who are not always attending school. So perhaps people who are truanting or disruptive in class. You may look at people who have very, very strong genetic loading for substance problems. You may look, as you said, in communities where there's very high prevalence of drug use. That might be a place that you want to target your resources. And so relatively quickly, you can start building up a picture of who might be more vulnerable and where the resources around prevention might be best placed. As with any disease condition, the earlier you start treating it, sorting it out, the easier it is to fix.
So, I mean, I was going to ask you about, you know, what are the biggest game changers, but through having this conversation, you know, it seems to be that apps, so, I mean, I'm assuming that is one, it always is, but what do you think are the biggest game changers in this field for?
Well, I think within prevention, we've talked a little bit about education. I think there's an enormous opportunity for technologies around education. I've myself in the process of writing an app, an educational app at the moment for CAM services, so child and adolescent mental health services, around prescription medicines. And it's been really interesting to think how you use technology as a vehicle to transmit information or transfer information. In terms of harm reduction, the big game changers. So within drug services, the big changer is naloxone. So the provision of naloxone, which is an antidote to heroin, is a very, very important evidence-based but currently quite poorly implemented intervention. There are lots of interventions around alcohol. You've probably heard of minimum unit pricing. You've probably heard about some of the research that's been done about the size of glasses and measures in pubs. So some of these things are relatively simple but at a public health level, but they can have a huge impact. And again, you can link things like glass size to technology. So there are some very impressive apps that look at help people calculate how much they're drinking, because people often are quite poorly informed about that. And in terms of smoking, of course, well, the big debate at the moment is about vaping and the role of vaping as a way to get people away from smoking tobacco. In terms of treatment, I think the big game changers, well, probably the biggest game changer has been the involvement of patients in designing services.
So what I'm going to do now, if you don't mind, is pause there so we can hear from some of the innovators that I interviewed, then come back to you for your thoughts afterwards. Let's hear from the first one, David Crane, who's the creator of the Smoke-Free app. Let's go! So, David, thanks very much for joining us today. Do you think you could tell us a little bit about the innovation?
Certainly. So Smoke-Free is a stop smoking app that's based on NICE guidance and best practice for app development. We've been around for about 8 years now, 7 years, sorry. We were launched in February 2013 as a master's project for my psychology master's. And we've had about 4.5 million downloads so far. And we've got a 4.7 rating out of 5 from 150,000, usually quite grumpy, recently ex-smokers.
So tell us about how it works, David. What's the premise or concept behind Smoke-Free?
There's a couple of things that we try to do based on psychological theory. One is Rothman's theory of behavioural maintenance, which argues that we initiate a new behaviour when we're optimistic about the outcomes. And Rothman argues that we maintain a new behaviour only when we are satisfied with the outcomes that have been brought. And that's what we try to do with the app, is help people feel a sense of the gains that they have made, the time smoke-free, the money saved, the cigarettes not smoked, the health improvements that have been made. And then we also take people through a quit smoking plan, a 100-day program that tries to help them deal with the various challenges that are likely to arise during their quitting journey.
So I can see how it's the positive motivation, isn't it? And then there's the tools that you talk about. So I'm intrigued to hear more about that. So how does the app provide those tools?
So what we do is we digitize a lot of the delivery of face-to-face stop smoking services. There is about 42 different behaviour change techniques that have been identified as used in face-to-face services, and we digitise as many of those as we can. And the second thing is a standard treatment programme, which is what the National Centre for Smoking Cessation and Training recommends that stop smoking services deliver, and we've put that into a chatbot, essentially a conversational interface that hopefully allows people to form a stronger relationship with the bot, and when that stronger relationship is in place, then hopefully people are more likely to follow the recommendations that have been made.
Excellent. So it sounds like it's growing, I suppose, isn't it, in terms of its application, and you're going to be testing it as it goes on.
Exactly. I mean, I think there's a lot that we can do to contribute to understanding about how people change their behaviour. What we're dealing here, particular health domain, has broad applicability, I believe, because essentially what we're talking about is self-regulation. How do we prevent ourselves from doing something that brings immediate pleasure for future benefit? So I think that if we can understand the sorts of techniques that work for a particular individual at a particular moment in time, and more than that, how they are delivered. For example, with the chatbot, for example, some people may want at some point a more gentle, supportive, encouraging type approach. But then when they've lapsed, they may want something a bit more stern, a bit more Sergeant Major-y, pull yourself together type action. And understanding how the behaviour change technique should be delivered to individuals in a digital form, I think, is the thing that I would like us to really be able to contribute to.
So David, what sort of evidence have you got for the benefit of Smoke-Free App?
We've run two randomized controlled trials now. The first one had about 28,000 participants. And we found was that people who were randomly allocated to receive the missions were about twice as likely to remain smoke-free for 3 months as people who just used the basic features of the app. And the basic features of the app are the sorts of things that you find in most smoking cessation apps, the timers and the calculators. So we've got some fairly good evidence there that the app helps with quit rates. And then the second trial that we ran, this was with about 57,000 participants, looked at whether our chatbot, which delivers the standard treatment program, and what we found there was that people who were randomly allocated to receive the chatbot were about twice as likely to stay smoke-free for a month as people who received the basic features of the app plus the missions. I think we've got some pretty good evidence of effectiveness there.
Good stuff. It sounds like it. So David, you've got 4.5 million users. So this is people using it and getting it themselves on their phone. Is that the plan for going forwards, to have people buy it themselves?
What we want to do is to work with the NHS a lot more. And the other way that we're really helping it get out to people who might be interested is via Boots. So we've just done a deal with Boots where we are available in 1,400, I think, Boots up and down the country in the smoking cessation section. And so now for the first time, if you're going to a chemist and you're thinking about, well, how do I stop smoking? In addition to all the nicotine replacement therapy that's available, there is behavioural support. And behavioural support is the twin, you know, nice guidance is to use behavioural support and nicotine replacement therapy. But until now, the only thing that you've been able to buy in the chemist is nicotine replacement therapy.
Well, you've got 4.5 million users already. I don't know what you're aiming for.
World domination.
Best of luck with that one.
Yeah. Like we want to go into, you know, like I say, I think we want to go into weight management and activity. You know, 60-70% of all illnesses are non-communicable diseases. 40% of all premature deaths are from, you know, diseases that can be caused by helping people change their behavior.
People want convenience, and actually something like this gives them that opportunity.
I hope so, yeah, because I think it is accessible, it's convenient, hopefully it's rewarding.
Yep.
You know, we want to make sure, because behavior change is hard. You've got to continually make effort when the pull of the old behavior is just constantly there. So it needs to feel like the effort that you're making is worthwhile, and that today is better than yesterday, and hopefully tomorrow will be better still. And if we can instill that types of feedback into behavior change, then I think we'll get people sticking to their new behaviors for longer.
There you go. David, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been great.
Absolute pleasure, Hassan. Thank you very much for letting me on.
I then spoke to Maria Winkvist of Contigo Care.
Hi, is that Maria?
Yeah, yes, Maria here.
Great, Maria. Thanks for joining us today. So you're going to tell us today about this innovation called Previct from Contigo. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So Previct is an AI-based platform for addiction treatment, supporting the healthcare professional to be able to predict relapses and the patient in real-time support whenever they are.
And is this something that's in development or is it up and running already?
It's actually up and running. So it's a registered medical device now on the market.
So is it being used by hospital trusts? Is it being used by patients, community providers? Who's your client base at the moment?
Yeah, it's up running, and we have roughly 40% of the municipalities in Sweden, which is one of the key suppliers of outpatient treatment for addictions, and some of the biggest private addiction rehabilitation companies in Sweden that are using it. And we have also started to look into international markets. So in Finland, one of the largest private clinics in Helsinki is running Previct, and now started up also in Norway.
Wow. So can you try and just summarize for us, Maria, how it actually works? What does Previct do?
It's kind of a support for the patient. So the patient is like a digital assistant in your mobile. So they get a breathalyzer and they have the mobile with the app, and then they perform a breath test with photo ID 3 to 4 times a day. They get help to create good routines, get support if they have cravings. You can register feelings digitally and report well-being and mood. And we are following this because it's sent away in real time. And then we analyze this information and we start to see patterns. And we could see when patients deviate from his or her own patterns, which we called addiction monitoring index. And that's a kind of risk factor of kind of relapse coming in the near future. So we could kind of display all this information in a very easy way for healthcare providers, so they could kind of support the patient in an optimal way. And they could also prioritize patients. So like say, if you have 100 patients, you will see which 10 that are red patients, a high risk patient. You will see the 20 that are yellow, with middle risk patients, and you will see the 70 that are green. That means that you could transform time from the green ones and give to the high risk ones. So you could kind of give right treatment to the right patient at the right time.
Wow. And so tell me, how does the AI element of this work?
We have right now here, we have this facial recognition. So when you take perform the breath test, it's a photo taken, so you have to guarantee that it's a right person performing the test. And then we could kind of use this technology so the healthcare provider do not have to look at each and single picture. And then it's also this that we have started out testing from the clinical trials, where it's not included yet, but we have kind of a publication, or we have shown that we, with our models, could see a relapse coming between 3 to 5 days before it actually occurs. So that gives this trend, and then we have created this sobriety index. So it's a kind of risk index based on if the patient performed the test, if there's low amount of alcohol, and these kind of things. And in the future, of course, we will bring in more and more of this data from the well-being, from cravings, and all these kind of things to even further improve the possibility to predict relapses.
Oh, I see. And how does the breathalyzer work, Maria? Is it connected to the phone somehow, or is it...
It's Bluetooth connected, so it's a small breathalyzer like a matchbox. So you can have it in your pocket or whatever you like. And in a minute or two, you have performed a breath test with this photo ID. So you could, in case you have stigma or you not want to face it, to want someone else, you could go to the bathroom and do the test. And quite often they perform the test 3 to 4 times a day.
So the patient uses the breathalyzer, it connects to the phone, tells the levels, and so what the intention is that, what, they won't drink, and it's a check-in to show that they aren't drinking, so to maintain sobriety, is that?
Yeah, it's a support to keep sober, and it's also sometimes, he could look at the first glance as a control, but most patients describe this as actually freedom, because they have quite often a long history of failure when it comes to drinking. And some of them describes it like, for the first time I get relief because I do not think of drinking, because I know I will do and perform my test soon. And for others, it could be that I could show to my relatives and to the closest one that I am actually sober, which is a kind of great relief. And sometimes that means that they could have the kids again, that they will be able to work and so on.
And have you got promising results from using Previct then, Maria?
Yeah, I'm happy that you ask. Actually, we have we're very proud to have published 2 articles where we have identified the first 2 digital biomarkers for alcohol addiction in the world, actually, which makes me very excited, since I did my PhD in cancer research. And it was biomarkers, as you know, that drastically changed the way of cancer treatment. And now we have this first digital biomarkers for addiction which could hopefully make a big impact on treatment. And then we had the other publication, which is together with Uppsala University, where around this AI model and the predicting of relapses.
Excellent. And I see, I'm looking at your website, there's mention of Pravict gambling, I believe, as well. So is that the next phase of this?
Yeah, exactly. So right now we have alcohol and gambling out. And we aiming also for drugs, so that would further expand the Pravict platform to also include drugs.
Oh, excellent. And what about, when we talked earlier on, you talked about expanding beyond Sweden, so you talked about Finland, and so is the growth, what are you expecting with this?
Of course, it's a new way of working, so it takes time. Even though we have 40% in Sweden, it doesn't mean that it's a full scale. So we still will work in Sweden on the scaling and kind of the change management, because it's a new way of working, of course, with kind of information before and what you should do. So it's a huge transformation of how you could work. But we right now have started up in Finland and in Norway. But we've been out in Europe as well, looking there, and the response is really good. But we're a small company, so we take each small steps, of course. But who knows, someone out there listening right now in UK would be interested as well, and that would be lovely.
Well, Maria, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been really interesting.
Oh, it's really, really lovely to talk to you. And I do hope that it could be something in the future that will be in UK as well.
I hope so. Let's go, let's go.
Finally, I spoke to Tim Sampi about Build on Belief.
Hi, is that Tim?
Good afternoon. Yes, it is. Hello.
Hey, Tim. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
I'm really looking forward to hearing about Build on Belief. Tell us where it came from. Where was the idea from? Was it yourself that set it up? How did it come about?
I was part of it. It came from myself and a group of my friends, with pretty much only one exception. Everybody employed by Build on Belief has had an addiction problem, and everybody employed by Build on Belief volunteered for it first. And we were quite conscious of the fact that useful, in fact, life-saving, though, structured therapeutic support was, there was a bit missing. There was no space for us to learn to re-socialise, nowhere that kind of felt safe. I have always thought that one of the defining factors of addiction is social isolation. By the time you get to the end of it, you are alone. And therapeutic support can't work all by itself, you know. Unless you're a psychopath or a monk, people need people. So it was just to create a space where people could meet other people. And instead of talking about how bad things used to be, I don't know, play a guitar, paint a picture, do a bit of mindfulness, get something to eat, chat about how good Game of Thrones was last night, and socialise in a safe space with people who understood the problems they were facing. It's simple, really.
And looking at your website, Tim, it says, I think it's something like 38,000 contacts in the year 1819. And that's a staggering amount. If it's just, is that also just on the weekend then?
Most of them are just on the weekend. We have two services that kind of bleed into the week. So there's a big one in Ealing that is open 5 days a week. And there's one in Hillingdon that's open 5 days a week. All the others only open up on a Friday night, Saturday and Sunday.
And so you don't address the substance misuse and addiction, it's sort of like a completely separate safe space, is it?
It is, but there's an interesting argument about role modelling. The one thing that's unusual with Build on Belief is that we're very open about the fact we've all had this problem. So in a way, we're role modelling the possibility of change. I have had a million conversations about what it's like to be in treatment or to be in rehab, about some of the difficulties I might have faced personally. So I think providing a space where people can see it can be done and where they can talk to their peers in a completely open fashion provides a new level of support. But it's like the cement between the bricks of the treatment system.
That sounds great. I mean, Tim, are you able to perhaps, you know, give us a story? Have you got a recent client story that you could share with us? Anonymously, of course, just around what sort of impact it's had for them and what they did?
Well, you know, I remember years ago, I don't run a service anymore, but I used to run the original service. And we used to have a lovely fellow that would come in pretty much every weekend over a period of 2 years. And at that time, he was a heavy drinker. And what was interesting was he turned around one day and said, well, how do I join in? How do I get to be one of you? And all we said was, well, rein in the booze a bit. If you can turn up here and not be drunk, you can volunteer. And what was interesting was he made the effort to do that, not to drink, because he wanted to become part of a community. He wanted something else. And because our ground rules are very different.
And you're very, it sounds like you're very inclusive as an organisation, aren't you?
Well, essentially, if you're not under the influence when you turn up to volunteer, if you're not a danger to other people, okay. Then you can volunteer. We have no other criteria.
And what sort of stuff? So you mentioned, I think, playing the guitar. And what sort of stuff happens there, Tim?
Well, it depends. All the services are completely different. So I have a model and a set of policies and procedures and a framework. Each service, the staff and the volunteer team decide what the activities will be. So if you go to North Kensington, they've got a full-scale rock and roll band workshop. But over in Hillingdon, they prefer to have a gardening club. So it's down to the local volunteers and service users to decide what they want within a set budget, and as long as it's not dangerous. What would you find interesting? You know, one service has a chess club, one service has a knitting club. I'm not interested in knitting, but if that's what people want to do and it helps, knock yourselves out.
And how, at the minute, how are you funded? Is it your charity, or is it funded through CCGs?
No, it's a registered charity. In one authority, we're grant funded by the local authority. Right. Everywhere else, we subcontract to the main providers.
I see. And I suppose I should ask, are you aware of any research that you've been involved in or research around this sort of approach that helps with addiction?
Around peer-led services? That's a really interesting question. We did a couple of impact evaluations, which are on our website. But in some quarters, they've been dismissed because they're not university-backed. So at the moment, we're talking to the University of East London about the possibility of doing a proper university-backed evaluation of peer-led services nationally. Because one of the problems we have in trying to provide these services is we know that it works, but proving it can be quite difficult.
It's always a challenge, isn't it? But anecdotally, you'd say that actually it supports and it's quite successful without being biased, of course.
Oh, absolutely. And you only have to look in this month's Drink and Drug News magazine, and the recovery champion said exactly that. They are very important. And our volunteer teams are amazing, absolutely amazing. The amount of effort and commitment and enthusiasm they put into it is astonishing. We have 8 services. We only have the equivalent of 15 full-time members of staff. And we have about 200 volunteers.
Wow. So it's really, it's not to sound cheesy, but it's built on passion, really, isn't it? Your workforce.
In the treatment system, there's a term you hear a lot is mutual aid. And it normally refers to things like 12-step meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, SMART meetings. We've always viewed this as an interactive form of mutual aid. It's just us guys getting together and doing our best to help other people out in the same situation because it makes us feel better.
Tim, genuinely, it has been really exciting to hear about Builder Belief. It's simple, but it's powerful. And that comes down to A, the concept, and B, the people that are involved in it, people like you that have led it. So it's great to hear about that.
That's very kind of you.
So Owen, it was really interesting for me speaking to some of these developers of these apps and technologies, particularly the positive reinforcement element of it. Interested to hear your thoughts on them.
Well, firstly, it was hugely exciting to see these three different approaches. And, you know, it's exciting to think how they might be used in my patient group. I mean, a few thoughts, I suppose. One, that it was very nice to see that they sort of talked about each of the three components, so prevention, harm reduction and treatment. And so there was very much a sense that these were tackling all elements of that. I suppose one of the things I always think about when I see new technology is the medic in me wants to see the evidence that it actually does work. And I suppose my advice to these innovators would be make sure that you're doing the evaluations and the research to be able to sort of very clearly demonstrate the benefit. And I suppose the other thought is that it's important that these sorts of apps are trialled in different patient groups. So coming back to all the way back to the WHO classification of harm, we talked about hazardous, harmful and dependent. It's much harder to get a dependent person to change behaviour than it is someone who's using hazardously. And so one thing that would be quite important would be these technologies are trialled in the different groups to see what impact they have in those.
So excellent advice for these and future innovators, I'm sure. Thank you, Owen. So Owen, I've really enjoyed talking to you today, especially hearing about your experience and the clinic, and I'm hoping I can try and replicate some of that locally. I'll be chatting to my community health provider as well about how we can do some of that. It's clear that you're passionate about this, and it's clear that you have a fantastic wealth of experience in terms of treating addiction and substance misuse.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.